Vern Fiatah, and this is study of Luke 24, 13 to 35, the Road to Emmaus passage, which I've entitled Recognitions. Next week we do stories that Jesus told. This week we've done stories about Jesus from different parts of the Gospel of Luke and a bit of Acts. I've really... One of the things that has been good for me was to have a sampling of different texts and different places in the book. And I want to commend to you working through the Bible piece by piece and making more stories your own. I think that a lot of the problems are not because people know some Bible, but because they don't know enough Bible. They don't sense the richness, the depth, the complexity. And it's quite exciting to see the variety and richness. For example, we've had a Jesus story that was basically confrontive in the home congregation. We've had a Jesus story where... Basically, he let this woman break up the party and wash his feet. We've had a Christ story with Cornelius and Peter, where Peter responded to a dream and changed the history of the church. We've had a story where Jesus wept over Jerusalem. Jesus as a human being enmeshed in a wide range of life experiences. And now today we have a whole other kind of story. We just have a whole other kind of story with this memory of the conversation with Jesus on the road to Emmaus. The other thing I want to underline again is that this way of working with Bible is to take the Bible as our beginning and as our starter, not as our finisher. What finishes the Word is what we do. So that the Bible is much more like the yeast than it is like the flour. We're the flour. We're the people that need to be kneaded and raised and gotten out of the doldrums. The Bible is much more like the salt than it is like the soda. Noel, soda's pretty yeasty too. Than it is like the flour. It gives flavor, it gives direction, gives motivation. So it's really, I think that at least one sector of the community is turned off by Bible because the Bible has always been used to end conversations. And so there's nothing more to talk about. This is what the Bible says, so shut up. Don't think anymore, just do what you're told. And that just has, until the Bible gets back to being yeast and leaven and light, I don't think they're going to touch it. Big job to take care of the, to keep redoing the system so that they all work and take care of. And it's been good to see now the last few years that they're taking steps to rework different parts of the system. Let's see, where were we?
The Bible as a starter, not as an ending place.
Yeah. Okay. The beginning of conversations and actions and to get into a process where there's listening and reflection and action will enable bits and pieces of all different parts of the Bible to be part of us. So the Luke-Acts story is a story of the spirit. It's the story of a journey. Notice that both images are process images, dynamic images. They're not images of things that are fixed. They're images of people alive, breathing, moving. It's a story of moving from Jerusalem to Rome. And the thing that has struck me this time around has been the kind of risk-taking in all of the situations, the kind of mystery, the kind of openness in the situations. So Jesus took risks to talk bluntly in his home church. The woman took risks to go to that dinner. Jesus is kind of breaking rules when he weeps and confronts, sees destruction. Risks. Cornelius and Peter both certainly took risks. That this whole business of being loose and spirit-led enough to go on a journey, to go on a journey, as the prayer says, without knowing where you're going to end. Okay, now the text today, Luke 24:13-35, the Road to Emmaus story, is one of the resurrection scenes. I think it's very important that the church, that as Christians, we get clear about the kind of feel of the resurrection story. It's really quite important, because I think that when we move from crucifixion to resurrection, we're moving into from the known to the unknown. We're moving from something we can see quite concretely to something we have only glimpses of. And let me illustrate this by just recapping what the texts of the resurrection are like. Now, it's perfectly clear that from the time of the early Christians, you would not have had an early Christian community without resurrection appearances, ascension, vision, Paul on the road to Damascus having a vision of Jesus, sparks flying on Pentecost, all of those stories in different way testify to the transition from the Jesus whose feet smelled to the disciples who carried on the Christ work. But the pictures, when you talk about crucifixion, Mark has, for example, a whole block, a third of the, about 16 chapters in Mark, that would be about five, six chapters of Mark, are about the crucifixion. We can make a crucifixion story, we can have sermons, we can have lessons, we can have prayers, every single week in Holy Week. And every one of them will be different, because we know that much about the last week of Jesus' life. What happens when we get to resurrection narratives? What happens? If we had the Gospel of Mark and nothing else, we would barely have a matin service, a 20-minute matin service, after a Good Friday service. Mark has an empty tomb story. They go to the women, of course, go to the tomb, hear the news that he's gone and that he's risen. And you know how the Gospel of Mark ends? And they went out and fled from the tomb for trembling and astonishment, and they said nothing because they were afraid. That's it. That was a congregation that had a glimmer of resurrection, but not much, that lived largely by the crucifixion, by the cross, and had this just hint of resurrection, but no appearances. Matthew comes along, and in addition to that part of the story, there's an encounter between Jesus in which he says, "Don't be afraid. Go tell him to meet me in Galilee." And in Galilee, there's a little scene where the Great Commission, where responsibility gets turned over to the disciples. That's not much. Just enough of a reappearance to sort of turn the shop over to the successors. That's not much. Luke, this is a major story, very much of the texture of Luke, because it's a journey, it's a conversation, it's a slower, mysterious scene in which the disciples don't recognize Jesus and then do recognize Jesus, and Jesus disappears. Much more developed, richer, but still just a glimpse. And the minute they get it, he's gone. There's John has a more elaborate, John has a more elaborate appearances of Jesus to the disciples, but in every case, after brief recognition scenes, Jesus is gone. And the disciples never have anything of resurrection to hold on to, but that those moments and glimpses. They never really have the same concreteness that they have with the cross. So that in a way, I think it's important that Christians realize that in a very real sense, you can practically smell the cross, but you get glimpses of resurrection. And the church lives by hanging on to the cross and looking to resurrection. So we're into resurrection glimpses. We're past some of the texture of kind of grounded, rooted stories. And we're into these little glimpses, these moments, like the moment of being on a mountaintop at Transfiguration. And then all of a sudden they're gone. You know, you've got to hold them for a weekend and then you're out of it and it's gone. It's gone. And you're just not going to toddle back in here every time you feel blue. And that's part of life too. That's part of life too. There are some of those glimpses that move us along that we never can grab by the hand. One of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me was when a student friend of mine took me on a hike to Cloudy Pass. And we camped overnight in the snow. And just by chance, we woke up to see sunrise. Mm. And the view of the top of the mount. I don't think I'll ever get to the top of the mountain. You know, I don't think I'll ever climb Glacier Peak. I don't think I'll ever climb Bonanza. I haven't got enough guts or muscle left for that. But I tell you, I take my hikes always looking at the top of the mountain. And the top of the mountain is pretty important to me. The top of the mountain is what I set my sights by. Even if I can only catch a glimpse of it and not plant my garden there. So don't put down glimpses. Don't put down glimpses. There are some things we only need one or two snapshots of to keep us going, and to keep us going in the right direction. But don't pretend you're on top of the hill when you're only halfway up the mountain, or you won't get any place. You know, halfway up the mountain is only halfway up the mountain. A day's journey is only a day's journey. But that's all right. Some days it's clear. And you get to see the top of the mountain. And when the mountain is so gorgeous, maybe seeing it is enough for some of us to live by. Okay, Road to Emmaus. I had never noticed 7 miles before. Going to a village named Emmaus about 7 miles from Jerusalem. I didn't notice that until the day I was reading this, the day after or the day or something around the time we had hiked to Holden Lake and back, and that was 8 miles. I was so pooped. And the story is about them going 7 miles, and then at the end they get so fired up they trot back the 7 miles to tell the disciples what happened. And I thought, oh my goodness gracious, this is a journey. Talk about a jog. This is just, these people really got fired up and jogged along. You know what somebody told me? One of the kids, excuse me. But he had jogged up to Heart Lake after Vespers one night. But he likes to jog, so that's fine. Well, it's nice to be fired up. So, in Jerusalem, talking with each other about the things that were happening. You know, they're laying low. They're not hanging around the temple. They're not hanging around Pilate's place. They're heading for the hills. And Jesus turns up, and they don't recognize him. Oh, Tamai. They don't recognize him. I mean, here they were hanging around the cross for half a dozen hours. And they must have known something about him, and they don't recognize him. That's interesting. Interesting. You think you know Jesus, and then you can walk right by him, and you don't even know him. That's interesting. Even really devoted people, you can be... You know what? You know the most important thing that I learned in my 50s was that there were things that were real that I hadn't seen. There were things that my sons taught me that I had completely not seen. That I'd been involved in denial. And I'm sort of smart. Read a lot of books, gone to school a long time. You know, I spend a lot of time trying to think of the things I forgot. It's wild. It's wild. You know, this is real stuff. You know, you can live with somebody. I mean, it happens. There are things, every once in a while I find out something about my wife that's just, I never even dreamed that. You know, this is real stuff. And you can have been with them for 3 years and you still don't recognize them. Anyhow, I think they're just some, it's just, these stories are fun. They're fun because they're just so full of little, little stuff that is says, hey, these people weren't so different than we are, and sure, it's nice if you recognize them, but you know, let's face it, ain't always the case. What are you talking about? Somebody shows up and he says, are you the only one that doesn't know what happened? And notice then Cleopas's account, Jesus of Nazareth, prophet, mighty indeed in word. Prophet. There you get the typical early Christian recognition of Jesus. This guy's a preacher, this guy's a bearer of the word. He acts, he speaks. And notice very careful, Luke is quite careful at this point. It's the chief priests and the rulers. He's not saying the Jews crucified him, because he knows perfectly well Jesus is a Jew. Early Christians are Jews. He's saying that the establishment, the people who had to lose from Jesus' social criticism, are the people that brought him to death. And we had hoped, notice the tentativeness, we had hoped that he would set Israel free. And so you even wonder, did some of these Christians still really think that Jesus was going to be not just a reformer but a revolutionary and start get independence from Rome? Yet, and besides all this, this is the third day, and some women amazed us. That could be a little ironic. I don't know whether they believe the woman or not believe the woman. It's a little hard to tell. The women amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning. They did not find his body, but they came back saying that they had had a vision and that he was alive. And some of us went to the tomb and found it, but we didn't see him. So there's still a little... It's kind of, you don't know quite where it's at with them. And Jesus starts talking to them. Wake up, folks. Don't you pay attention to the prophets? Isn't it necessary that the Messiah suffer, enter into his glory? And he begins to interpret scriptures concerning himself. But still nothing happens. There's a good lesson, but nothing clicks. And then they drew near to the village to which they were going, and they said, well, why don't you stay with us? And the day's just about done, so he went in to stay with them, and when he was at table, he took the bread and blessed it. He said grace and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were open and they recognized. Typical resurrection. And then he disappeared. All they get is recognition. Did not our hearts burn within us when he talked and when he opened? And they returned to Jerusalem, and somebody said, well, Simon has seen him. And they told what had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of bread. That's a pretty neat story. Pretty subtle story. So what gets to you? What do you wonder about? Images, what parts of it kind of are important?
Well, that 7 miles is interesting, too, because if you think of them coming back from Jerusalem and try to think what it must have been like to suddenly say, hey, he was 7 miles away, too. You know, somebody saw him 7 miles away. It's kind of like if anyone was just thinking, well, maybe he wasn't really there and he just appeared, it would be kind of breakthrough. Or that he came back to life, escaped from the tomb. Suddenly that he had been in Jerusalem and then he appeared 7 miles away in Emmaus would give people kind of a supernatural tingle, I would think, to say, you know, oh, we can't deny something unusual happening here.
I like the word mystery better than supernatural.
Yeah.
Supernatural questions come in with the 18th century when people invent the natural. Mm. And back there, you're pre-natural, supernatural arguments. And I really think it's important that we... You gotta bring the Bible into the century, but I'd rather bring the Bible into the 20th century than the 18th when we're in the 20th. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's enough to cope with the 20th rather than the... But little by little, you know, this one has one glimpse and this one has another glimpse and this one has another glimpse. And Paul even calls his appearance of Jesus on the Damascus Road, his vision on the Damascus Road, an appearance of the risen Lord. So it's there's just all different kinds of little glimpses.
I think the thing that, you know, touches me is, you know, kind of what you made reference to, is that, you know, here, you know, with some of the closest friends that had spent 3 years with him, they had been 8 with him, they had listened to him, they've just been with him during all those times, and now, you know, they're questioning everything that he had taught them. And how hurt he must have felt to have shared all that with them and then to return and they don't even recognize him.
Mary didn't recognize the garden, the gardener.
Thought he was the gardener, yeah.
You know, how hurt, I just feel so bad he had suffered so much. I just, you know, feel for him.
On the other hand, it's sort of the thing of kind of a foreknowledge of how hard it is to and why the need for the Holy Spirit is there.
Because that's right, it was the transformation.
Well, just the idea that within the world, it is not, there isn't just flashes of light to tell you exactly what the path is that Christ is bringing in us. But it is, you know, it's a change. It's a change to that now it's a journey. But it's not going to be the same as it was before, where there was someone that was just kind of leading them by the hand, telling them exactly what they were going to do. But it's kind of a foreshadowing of that need for the Spirit.
I guess the other thing that strikes me about this is, to expand on that a little bit, is that they were blind to him when they were on the road, but we're also blind to him today. Mm-hmm. We walk right by him all the time. If he was hurt by them not recognizing, or hurt by them not believing what was going to happen to him, that must go on all the time today when we don't see Christ in the issues that we've been talking about this week.
And how
can
we
go deeper?
Well, that very same thing, though, to me, it's comforting, because what it tells me is that I know that even though I've lived my whole 40 years already, I know that there are still all these opportunities that I'm going to probably see things differently tomorrow than I am now. It's just like there's this possibility of always looking at things in a new way.
And it is in process, and I'm going from it.
And I guess the people that I feel the sorriest for are the people who say they're bored. And I wondered, how can you be bored with life? I mean, you can be bored with the particular task you have at the moment, but there's there's just so much out there, and the more you live, the more you know there's so much more to find out and to learn, and there's always that possibility. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that I just thinking of all the things that I'm sure I'm going to find out and see in a different way in the future is one of the things that keeps me going and makes me kind of excited about life. Mm-hmm. And so instead of seeing them as people who were, you know, sort of put down, why didn't they know this man they've been with for 3 years, I see that they were still learning about him, and they too have a lot yet to go. The future is coming.
For those of us that work with a theology of the cross, and an eschatology like Matthew's, where if you do it, to ministry to those in need is ministry to Christ. You know, how much of my life have I not known about Christ in Namibia? Do I avoid the kinds of suffering that are signs of presence in our world? And so it is at least some acceptance of the process that maybe hearing and putting it together is something that happens by stages, bits and pieces. I don't know whether we see Judas where in all places it is. I after Vespers last night, I didn't want to talk about anything, you know. I can only take so much dying at one time, you know. So that subtle recognition is a mysterious process. I really, the older I get, the more people tell me of different ways of recognizing. So the less I know how recognition is going to happen. I know some of the things you can do while you're on the road to get people ready for recognition, but I don't know when and how recognition happens. I think that's a kind of, there's a kind of mystery to that.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I think we do with ourselves is that we kind of decide where Christ is and decide where we're going to put him so that we can literally recognize him in some places and some things that and that we might be just putting ourselves in the next thing set up in the same place that we're operating in the place of prayer and maybe we can put it home.
Oh, I think you've put your finger, I mean, that's a long conversation, but I think you have really put your finger on something so subtle that it's very complicated to talk about, this business of how much our anxiety gets us to make Christ into a thing, and that a living Christ is always on the road, and always, in some sense, always a jump ahead. So that what you really, where you met him yesterday, may not be exactly the same place as you find him today. He may be the same Christ, but he may not be at the same point in your day's journey. Or he may not speak to you through the same person that he spoke to you through yesterday. And this whole business of Christ movement, I think that's really a powerful image to get there.
There are a lot of people that are born in a place, 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 in a
But you know, that's a real... But see, that's a tricky thing, because we need the snapshots, we need the memories, we need the icons to recall, to bring back the moment. We need the old stories to recover the action, the spirit. But you know, yes, I agree with you. But I don't think that we're taking the risk.
You don't do it intentionally.
I don't think that happens for some people, but some people take the risks and they never know whether they did it right or not. Peter and Cornelius had no way of knowing what would come of what they did.
Well, for Peter anyway, he had a relationship with Jesus.
He took the risk because of that relationship, but don't read in that he knew what was coming up.
But there are certain things that he tells us in his word that all things do together.
You didn't read that passage right. You go back and read. He did not say the best. He said good. There's a difference.
All things work together.
But good, God can patch up any mess we make, but it does not promise that everything we do is the best.
Right, because they can work together for us.
If God wants him to, he can patch up a mess. I want to keep the openness in. I want to keep. Sometimes you get that assurance. But I just know I have tons of friends who are running risks, and we don't know for being whether we've done the right thing or the wrong thing, and we're just glad that somehow God will sort it out in the end, and I may go to my grave without knowing whether this was the right road to take, whether I was carrying the thing to Rome, or whether I should have gone to Cairo, or whether I should have gone to Alexandria, or whether I should have gone to Carthage, you know, or should have gone to Damascus, but I went to Rome. Don't.
And he tells us not to look back.
Okay. Sometimes we look forward, sometimes we look back.
This may be a little bit off, but when I think about recognitions, I guess what I think, and maybe this is, I think about one of my hardest challenges is sometimes being to be open to other people's recognition and to not somehow institutionalize or see a hierarchy even of different recognitions. And I think that's being in the social justice area, too. There can be a real sort of looking down on those or other recognitions. And it's a hard tension to say, you know, we have a student Christ in the third world, and so then if some people have a hard time student Christ in the third world, it's kind of like a judgment on that in the recognition of where Jesus is. And that's a constant struggle for me, and to realize that nobody have all the the recognition for their Christ is. And so you to validate that other people can have recognitions that I'll never achieve it. And it's an ongoing. So I've been helped by a church that is a lot of anxiety. There may be some people who have some recognition, but I sometimes it's probably
But that points up, you know what you were doing, you were reading this story, you were entering the story from Jesus' point of view and saying, hey, didn't you get it? And then he explains it to him over again, and they still don't get it. Dumb. I showed you all those pictures. I showed you all those pictures of Nicaragua. Don't you get it? What's the matter with you? which is to say that, you know, this whole business of the difference between education and teaching and recognition, because education is something we can do to share experiences and information, but recognition is something that happens to a person. And you can't control the recognition. That recognition is much more mysterious than... And it's the same thing with the resurrection story. Everybody had a different version of different clue. Everybody had a different glimpse, and they don't all add up to the same scene. You know, somebody has a glimpse over here, and somebody has a glimpse over here.
That's the hard part of it. Because there's like frustration of someone not being able to see it since your glimpse.
Yeah.
<Right. laughs> Very difficult. You know, you give this presentation on another trip, let's say your trip to Nicaragua, and you want them all to go out of there thinking, I never knew that. Oh, now I see it in a different way. And if they don't, you know, you just think, well, what's the matter with you? Why didn't you see that? You know, I saw that. Why didn't you see that? That's the hard part.
It's the
easy part to change yourself. It's the frustration knowing that other people may not have been changed by the thing that changed you. That's frustrating.
Or you go back from Holden, you try to tell them you had a great time. The hardest thing for we had 22 students that we took to the Middle East for 5 months from St. Olaf. And the re-entry, the hardest thing about the re-entry is, we ended up eating once a week with about half of our group for the whole semester after we got back. Because the hardest thing was about re-entry, you come back to your friends, to your campus, mm-hmm. and people ask you, how was it? And they listen for 5 minutes and that's it. That's it. So you just want to touch the people that were there with you and say, was it real? Was it real? You know, you have these, and so this business of sharing vision, and give a little bit of information, but sharing the vision, there's a lot of pain in that. There's a lot of pain in this. Look at, here it is, a happy, cheerful, upbeat resurrection story. And oh my goodness, it's a realistic, painful story. It just comes out of the way things are.
I think one important thing is, even though they didn't recognize him and didn't understand all he had taught them, they were still open and receptive when they did recognize. They were still searching. When they went to tell others, they were still in the process, as we are, of trying to find out. They didn't fully understand, but they had not rejected.
No, they were searching. They weren't closed. They weren't running away. They just didn't get it. They just didn't add it up. Anybody turn on to this business of that the things fit together when they have the meal? That it's the breaking of bread? That it's saying the blessing? That the absolutely the most ordinary part of the Jesus story is to say grace. I mean, it's just the most, you know, it's just the most typical thing. I'm sure they did it every time they had a meal, not just the Passover meal, you know. To have, oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for you are good, your mercies endure forever. That's just the most ordinary, everyday action of Jesus. It wasn't the cross, it wasn't the suffering bit, it was just that little... That's what puts it together. That's what puts it together. So that somehow the extraordinary and the ordinary kind of are part of the are part of the mix. And so we go on having our meals together and have our family meals and chit-chat away and say our blessings. Sometimes we move along the road in the dark, and sometimes it all gets put together, so it's all sort of, there's recognition.
I think one of the frustrating things for you is to be sure that you're operating within your recognition and not say that whatever you're doing is what God is doing. In other words, sometimes I feel like I'm working backwards and I say, whatever I'm doing, I know this is what God has wanted me to do, and this must be right. And sometimes I need to stand back and think, you know, say, show me, is this what I should be doing? Or, in other words, not try to tell him what I'm doing, and that's okay, to work from this.
And even that's a process.
Oh, sure.
Because maybe you pray that one day, and you don't know any more at the end of that day than you did in the morning, and then the next day something happens and you get a little bit of glimmer and you begin to think, hey, maybe I should take this one instead of this one, and well, journeys are pretty fascinating. The sure thing, they're not cut and dried. Well, is there anything to do about this text? Say grace. Remember to say grace. I kind of wish that sometimes the celebration of the Eucharist with the church family would sound more like grace, so everybody caught the connection. Because I have the, you know, this business of recognition, I think some of it has to do with an echo effect. I've lived to so many people who either want to celebrate the word or they want to do social action. And I got this, you know, I just hear it as an echo back and forth. That it's here, and it's here, and it's here, and it's here, and then you're surrounded. But to get these connections, because obviously the Passover meal of Jesus was a meal, and obviously our family meals are the time when we're closest to our family. I think my most strong memories of my parents are all at supper time. Absolutely, my sense of family is supper time. If you can have it. It's a major work even having a meal together nowadays. I mean, maybe once a week? Well, I guess this is it. We're on the road now. Enough camping and enough of a rest stop. It's time to get on with the journey and head for the mountains and head to the or head for the plains, whichever way you're going. And thanks for the time. It's been good to be together, and hope we our paths cross someplace else, or here, or wherever.